Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us today are Michael Baer, the former chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who is now the chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. These two men have played a key role in presidential defense transitions over the past four decades. Michael and Arnold, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us,
Margo.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us twice this week. You guys joined us a couple of days ago when President-elect Joe Biden said that he wanted retired United States Army General Lloyd Austin to become the nation's 28th Defense Secretary. This was going to be a big lift. I think everybody in Washington knew that. You gentlemen, you know, we discussed that the chairman and the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, as well as the House chairman, had sort of indicated sort of a principled opposition to the idea of a retired four-star serving in this role with a waiver. Obviously, General Austin retired 4 years ago. He hasn't been retired 7 years, so a waiver is required. And now there's a question of maybe more extensive financial ties, although that's pretty clear for somebody senior and serving in board positions as he does in Raytheon and other companies. Is this going to be a bigger lift than people thought it was going to be and maybe closer run?
Well, Vago, there is nothing in the United States Senate anymore that is routine about a cabinet nomination compared to the time when I worked for Sam Nunn in the Senate for 24 years. And so all the cabinet nominees are going to have a great scrutiny. And I would say General Austin will not be an exception. He's going to face some very intense questioning and reviews on his policy knowledge and positions, whether it's great power competition or other issues. Obviously, there will be great focus on his financial ties. That's a pretty standard thing for the Senate Armed Services Committee, because you have to disclose, you have to divest, and you have to recuse. Obviously, there's going to be the issue of the waiver, and why should he get the waiver, and what's his case for civilian control? They're going to question his operational decisions when he was in various positions in the military. And the other complication is the House Armed Services Committee is going to play a role which has never happened before for a defense nominee, and that's a 55-plus member committee. It appears to me that they've agreed that he will have to testify as part of the waiver process, but also he will get asked all these same questions by another semi-quasi-confirmation committee. And then there's the clock. So there will be nothing routine about his confirmation process.
Michael?
Vago, I think it's Arnold taps the issues precisely. But I think it's also important to recognize that most of those elements are non-political. There are things these members feel very strongly about, some of this stuff, and the precedent they're setting. So if you think about it, the Secretary of Defense is not only in the chain of command, but he also overlaps the key advisory role of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They're both advisors to the president. You know, the committee will be looking at that independence and whether or not that independence is hampered when you get both individuals that have exactly the same lifetime, 45 plus years of experience, of background, of training and experience. We saw that unanimity of thinking with Generals Mattis and Dunford, and now the same is set up with the prospect of Generals Austin and Milley. So these are the kinds of things that the committees will be wrestling with. And as Arnold said, This will be a substantial lift. Over.
How significant is the issue of recusal? Because that becomes very, very problematic. In fact, Arnold, you've got a story about that, right? About the challenge of doing that. I mean, if I recall, everybody has liquidated their assets with the exception of Don Rumsfeld, who put them in a blind trust.
Well, Vago, the Senate Armed Services Committee, going all the way back to the days of Dave Packard when he came in as Deputy Secretary of Defense, they had to close the stock market because he was going to have to divest so much Hewlett-Packard stock because of the SASC's longstanding requirement that anybody that's confirmed, the 60 people that go through the Senate Armed Services confirmation process for DOD, they have to sell anything that they or their family has financial interest in, any company of 25 plus thousand of them that do business with the Department of Defense. And so it, because the Senate Armed Services Committee wants them to be able to make decisions in these key positions when the department is spending $400 billion a year on goods and services, supplies and equipment. So they have to disclose it, they have to divest it. And now, of course, you always had the 1 year recusal, but administrations now have added additional years. So you could be in a position, depending on how many companies, in addition to the ones that have been well publicized, Raytheon, the second largest defense prime contractor, steel companies, others, he's gonna be recused at a minimum of a year, perhaps even longer. Now, for the Secretary of Defense is rarely involved in procurement decisions. So for him at that level, I don't see it as a big issue, quite frankly. And we've had other secretaries in similar situations, and it hasn't basically materially affected their ability to do their job. But it certainly applies when you get into the service secretaries, the acquisition executives, and people of that nature. So recusals and divestitures is a very important consideration as part of the Senate Armed Services Committee confirmation process. Over.
Michael, let me get your sense on the question of years after retirement, right? As you mentioned, Lloyd Austin wore an Army uniform for nearly 45 years, if you include his time at West Point. Lloyd Austin is who he is. Does it matter if Lloyd Austin gets tapped for this job at 10 years after retirement, 7 years after retirement, 4 years after retirement? I mean, is he a different person? I mean, weren't these the 10-year recusal done at a time, you know, in a different time, in a different age, to be the effective equivalent of, I don't want you to serve at all without, you know, I don't want a defense secretary to be a former military guy without coming out directly and saying that.
Well, Vago, yeah, it's the National Security Act was written a long time ago, 1947. And they were clearly, the framers of that act clearly wanted to ensure that there was civilian control of the Secretary of Defense. So there are a lot of people that have spent years thinking deeply about what that control means. But from my perspective, a key part of that is the worldview. It's the life experiences. It's the independence of judgment of that individual. But it's important to note that that original ban was 10 years. And to understand that at 1947, the typical four-star retired in their mid-60s. And here's the key point. In 1947, the average life expectancy of a male was 64.5 years in the United States. So when you consider the framers' 10-year ban from retirement, it legally prohibited them effectively for life. But then Marshall, as a five-star, who was interestingly enough different from Lloyd Austin or Jim Mattis, because as a five-star, he was on active duty until his death. So that waiver was even more problematic, but nonetheless was approved by a pretty good margin, 220-105 in the House of Representatives. Almost similar numbers for Mattis late years, decades later, 268-151. But interestingly enough, Marshall still had, there were 57 votes for Marshall and 11 against, and Mattis, 98-1. So we really are seeing a movement away from the framers' reluctance to do this, as well as the fact that, candidly, these generals are surviving. Like all Americans, we're living much longer. So a 10-year ban is frankly even more achievable now because most of the retired general officers live to be well into their mid-80s, if not 90s.
Okay. I know, Arnold, I know you're a little conflicted on this because you supported Jim Mattis's waiver, but what's your sense on this? Are the generals any different at 10 years of retirement? I mean, you know, you're retired Marine Corps Major General. I mean, were you different 3 years after retirement than you are 10 years after retirement?
Well, Vago, I think the key to this whole thing is the cumulative appointments of the 60 people that will go into the Department of Defense. Let's say you have General Austin as the Secretary of Defense. You're going to want to have an extremely strong Undersecretary of Defense for Policy a absolute civilian position. So that person has got great credibility and strength, not just with the Secretary of Defense, but with the National Security Council, with the president, and is a counterbalance to the Joint Staff, which in recent years has basically, two, in my view, dominated a lot of the decisions because of the potential weakness of the civilian staffs. And so when you have a cumulative effect of having not just one person with a waiver, but you have a lot of other retired flag and general officers serving in the other key 60 confirmable positions, the cumulative weight of that does undermine civilian control. So I don't think that would happen with a waiver for General Austin, but it would seem to me he's going to need to bring in a team. He's going to have a deputy that is a junkyard dog when it comes to management of the internals of the Pentagon and day-to-day operations. He's going to have the strongest Undersecretary of Defense for policy and the Assistant Secretaries of Defense that cover the regional areas to help him in those areas. He's going to have acquisition executives that basically understand we've got to get our technologies out to the warfighters much more quickly than we do now, and it's considerably less cost. So to me, it's the combination, it's the team that comes in to run the Pentagon, not just one individual. Over.
Bago, there's one other part of this, though. That is that this is job of Secretary of Defense is the second toughest job in America, and it needs the very best the nation can supply. Yet over the last several decades, the Hill and the executive branch have installed some pretty harmful provisions that have effectively disqualified classes of people based upon prior activities, employment, or financial situation. And the result of that is that today in a nation of a third of a billion people, at any one time, there are only three or four women or men capable of doing the job. So now we see that there are allegations that two of the most qualified people, Jay Johnson and Michelle Flournoy, they weren't picked, but they're eminently qualified. But they're the allegation they shouldn't be considered because of their professional activities. But those professional activities, if anything, better them for the job. If those sorts of strictures were adopted, the stack of eligibles for this top job nearly evaporates. And what you're left with are former members of Congress and retired generals. And opening up the waiver eases the path of generals into that path and provides an alternative to bringing in truly civilian prospective people. This is not critical of Lloyd Austin. It's just to say that we really have to think about what departure from regular order portends for the process and the outcomes. Over.
That's an excellent point, Michael, right? And especially so when you consider that almost every single general officer is going and serving an industry in some capacity, right? There's a Larry Spencer who goes to Whirlpool, but most of the time it involves some involvement with defense or whatever their old field was. Arnold, quick point by you, and I've got to ask you both a business board question before we part.
Well, Vago, I think I agree with Michael's assessment on the kind of people that ought to be able to come in defense. And the corollary would be, why are we punishing national security in the COVID right now with more people dying than have died in all the battles of World War II? We wouldn't want people to come in to run that have never worked in the medical industry and don't have knowledge of vaccines. And we wouldn't want to preclude them. So why would we want to preclude people that have tremendous expertise in national security from coming into the Pentagon? Over.
I completely agree. I'm the same way with politics, by the way, as both you gentlemen know, and some of our listeners know. Politics is art to it, and you've got to have seasoned politicians, just like, you know, you, as you said, you want a doctor. You know, if I want heart surgery, I want a heart surgeon. If I want a compromise bill that advances the nation's interest, despite opposition, you need professional politicians that are in that mix, as opposed to polarized firebrands. Let me ask you very, very briefly this question. Until last week, Michael, you were the chairman of the Defense Business Board. Arnold, you were on that. Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller decided to purge the board. In fact, many, many boards. Instead of asking you specific, and Michael, you were the founder of the founding chairman of the Defense Business Board. Arnold, you were in the first class. I know, Michael, over the years, how hard you've worked to make this nonpartisan. And in fact, all of these boards pride themselves on a lack of partisanship. Why are these boards important, very briefly, and what does the politicization of these boards mean? Arnold, I want to get your take as well.
Vago, that's a great question. Thank you. First of all, service in these boards is a tremendous privilege and honor, and in the business board particularly, because as you know, for decades in its earlier years, the Department of Defense led the business world in innovation and process. That's not the case today. Today, the business world, highly competitive, global, and IT-based, is really leading the Department of Defense in best practices. So that in an enterprise of which $740 billion a year are spent, the overwhelming majority of that on business paralleled kinds of activities, not the kinetic warfight, having people who can provide for the secretary and the deputy the very best insights of how the private sector is doing it globally is really critical to providing the most lethal survivable force. Over.
Vago, the Department of Defense, like any other cabinet department, can become very bureaucratic and very mired in the past. And it needs individuals from the outside with scientific expertise, policy expertise, business expertise to provide the Secretary of Defense with alternative views and to do that on an objective, nonpartisan basis. There's no room in the national security field for politicization. And it would be my hope that the incoming team, the incoming Secretary of Defense, will take actions to ensure that these very important outside objective advisory boards go back to their roots of being nonpartisan.
Amen.
Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope both of you have a great weekend. Looking forward to having you guys back on next week. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Vago.
Yeah, thanks, Vago.
And joining us now to discuss what continues to be a very busy week in Washington are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute Think Tank, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many hats is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Vago.
Always a pleasure.
Great to be back.
Likewise. Thank you.
Always a highlight to have you guys on. Michael, congratulations first for making it on the Hill's list of top lobbyists. So I guess from now, what do we call you? Like Iron Mike, the Dominator, Mike, the Dominator person. What is there a special title you'd like?
My mother is also very proud of me. Just embarrassed me on Facebook. I'm getting lots of notifications this morning.
Congratulations. Job well done. On a more serious note, there are now more than 281,000 Americans dead, about 3,000 dying a day because of coronavirus. I wish this day would be different from all others, not to mix my Hanukkah and Passover metaphors here, but let's start with the same set of questions that we've been talking about literally since the beginning of the year. Let's start with the stimulus. It looked encouraging, $908 billion, and now it looks a lot less encouraging, and there's a lot of confusing stuff going on because NDAA was looking good, appropriations was looking good. So let's start with the stimulus. Where are we? Where are we going?
Okay, so right now we're going nowhere. But so earlier this week on Tuesday, there were a lot of developments, but it's still unclear if they're going to be able to clinch a deal, not only by the end of next week, but before Christmas. So Bernie Sanders started rallying Democratic support for another round of stimulus checks. And actually, Congressman Senator Josh Hawley lobbied the president to support the idea. And now the White House is on board and including at least $1,200 in direct payments to individuals in any relief package. But the relief package that people are using as the guideline now, the one that's the bipartisan $908 billion package, does not include $1,200 in direct payments to individuals. Then Senator McConnell suggested that negotiators each drop their demands for state and local aid liability protection in order to reach consensus on a package. But that idea was quickly shot down by Democratic leaders who are saying, look, they're too close to an agreement just to throw in the towel on key provisions. And Pelosi released a pretty harsh statement where she said the bipartisan negotiations involving senators and members of the House have made good progress and must be allowed to proceed without Leader McConnell's obstruction. And then to add to the chaos, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin pitched Pelosi on a totally new $906 billion offer, which he said was crafted in consultation with Trump and GOP leaders. So, you know, this proposal would include money for state and local governments, liability protections, stimulus checks of $600, which is lower than what the others have been pushing for. So Pelosi and Schumer's response, they say this is unacceptable. And again, they both released, Pelosi and Schumer released a statement talking about the present obstruction. They feel the bipartisan talks are the best hope for a solution. But yet, there's still no legislative text, and they're really running out of time. And the blame game is already starting. So Senator McConnell slammed Pelosi the other day, and Chuck Schumer for rejecting the White House's offer, calling their statement bizarre and schizophrenic. Schumer shot back, saying the Republican leader, as usual, gave a very angry speech this morning. It would do a whole lot of good if the Republican leader would drop the daily tirades. And then Pelosi was asked by reporters about being in the room negotiating with McConnell. And she responded that, well, if that's a Republican thing's good for them, tell them to go meet with McConnell. So right now, no one seems to know what's going on with coronavirus relief package anymore. There's growing doubt behind the scenes that this is going to get done. However, Democratic members that I speak with, and I spoke to the new incoming chairman of the Appropriations Committee yesterday, say we will not go home unless they have a package. So as of last night, Pelosi is floating the idea of actually being here, if necessary, before or after Christmas to get this done. So still a lot remains to be seen. They'd really have to file a bill by Monday to get it done next week. So I think it's highly unlikely this bill gets done next week.
And as messy as stimulus was, NDAA is really kind of quite messy in its own right, right? So the House and the Senate at this point have both passed the NDAA by veto-proof majorities, but Republicans are still saying that they may support the president's veto. So there's a one-week spending measure, right? Walk us through what happened and what's going to happen.
So on Tuesday, the NDAA passed the House with, as you just mentioned, a veto-proof override majority of 335 to 78. So that gives them lots of cushion if they do have to do a veto override and if they were to lose some Republicans who are fearful of the president. It passed the Senate today 84 to 13. So again, they have a lot of wiggle room too, and there still is hope that the president does not veto the NDAA. However, as of today, I spoke to a senator earlier today on the Armed Services Committee who still is convinced that the president will veto. Now in the House, leader Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, voted for the NDAA, but has indicated if the president vetoes, he will support the veto. And I've already received indication from several other Republican members who have said, hey, look, I have voted for NDAA, but the president vetoes, I can't vote to override. However, I do believe that incoming ranking member Mike Rogers will work closely with Adam Smith to make sure they have the votes to override the president if he chooses to override. Now, the question also is, when does the president choose to veto the bill? And that also depends on when they get the bill to the president. Now, if the president vetoes the bill as early as this weekend or early next week, they could override them next week while the House and Senate still plan to be in session through the 18th. If not, it may require Congress to fly back to D.C. sometime before or after Christmas to override the veto. And that complicates matters depending on how many members actually do come back to vote.
And that's obviously in keeping with what the House Speaker has said, right? We've worked through the holidays. We can work through the holidays again because we have to get this done. At the end of the day, where are we now on the omnibus, right? Because in doing this, they also did a one-week measure.
Yes. So they, after passing the NDAA, they were able to hotline the CR after many threats of delay. So now we have a continuing resolution for one more week to take us through December 18th. So next week, the business will be to try and finish the omnibus appropriations bill and a COVID relief package. However, I think it's very unlikely at this point that a COVID relief package will be passed next week, and hopeful that an omni does. If it does not, a lot of things could happen. There's possibility of a CR into March, which would be devastating for defense. And then if there are no COVID relief packages passed next week, Pelosi is not going to let the House adjourn. She will keep the House here up until Christmas and come back again after Christmas to provide relief for America's families. And I think she will at some point have to force a compromise. But right now we're nowhere near it.
Do you see a government shutdown happening?
I do not right now, but that if it were to happen, it's a week from now. So we bought ourselves a week. We'll have to see what happens, but I still think a government shutdown is unlikely.
Mackenzie, I mean, what's your sense in terms of what's in the NDAA? What do you like? What do you not like?
Two things. It's a good bill and it was a good process this year. So, you know, that's equally important, I think, because, you know, I feel like Chairman Smith on the House side really learned and internalized what went wrong last year, I think, with the NDAA and dealing with the factions of his own party, and they're very strong positions at odds with each other in many cases, something Republicans have been dealing with for years. And, you know, there was really general agreement and comedy on most issues between the two chambers and the two parties. You know, it was really the president that was the outlier here in terms of getting to agreement. It was never really in question between the two chambers. You know, I would say this bill, the William Mack Thornberry authorization bill, has a strong emphasis on the Navy, which is where the White House wants to go, and on Asia. So my colleague at AEI, Zach Cooper, he put out an article this week that there are over 43 Asia-related provisions in the defense authorization bill. You know, everything from prohibiting circuit board purchases from China to joint training range exercises in the Pacific, you know, prohibiting reductions of forces in South Korea. Congress is trying to think ahead of where President Trump might go in his remaining weeks in office. You know, we've seen, obviously, Afghanistan, Somalia, Germany, Congress is clearly worried that he's going to aim his next target at troop reductions on the Korean Peninsula, and they want to get in front of that. And speaking of Germany, the Hill would halt essentially the troop reductions for a certain period of time, which is essentially for good. So, you know, again, good bill, good process. I would say the only, you know, one of the big glaring sort of things, items, policy focuses that was missing, though, that, you know, it's like when Senator Gillibrand really took the cause for sexual assault in particular cases, you know, but once she kind of moved on, Congress moved on, but this week's Fort Hood report is just damning and it's devastating. And I think it's not limited to Fort Hood. And I really think Congress is behind, truly has just taken their foot off the pedal regarding sexual assault and how the Department of Defense is dealing with it and on a service by service basis and changes that are needed. I'd say that's a big gaping hole that they're going to need to address next year.
And how does it get addressed and how big of an issue does it become, right? I mean, things like this have a tendency, as you said, right, of going away unless somebody's got their foot on the throttle. And one would imagine that a Biden administration will be, right, I mean, first female vice president and an administration that's trying to make diversity a hallmark and to try to tackle this issue would have a lot more resonance in a Biden administration, wouldn't it?
Yes, I would think so. And I would add, I expect, you know, the Biden team knows there's a lot of questions and concerns about Lloyd Austin's nomination. I expect not only a female Deputy Secretary of Defense nominee, but also services that have never had a woman as secretary of that service will, under the Biden administration, absolutely. In fact, I've been told that. So, you know, that'll sort of take the sting out a little bit of having the retired general. But yeah, to be honest with you, Vago, I don't know if it's not a cause, like the problem is that it's not been a real cause du jour inside the Pentagon. I give Secretary McCarthy a lot of credit, but it really shouldn't have, you know, it was too late after, you know, this private first class was murdered. So like, I think there does need to be a champion and that champion needs to be in partnership with ranking member or possibly Chairman Jack Reed of Rhode Island to make any headway.
We're going to move on and talk about Joe Biden's cabinet selections. The first week drew praise, right? Avril Haines, Tony Blinken, among those seen as being highly qualified. Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary, again, another highly qualified pick. But this week, there are folks who are saying that Biden's picks have been somewhat more haphazard, his selection or problematic. Let me put it that way. General Austin's pick, as we heard early in the program from Michael Barron, Arnold Panaro has some bipartisan opposition and maybe a tougher haul because he's a retired general officer. He's only been retired 4 years, not seven, and so we'll need a waiver. And then folks are asking why Dennis McDonough was picked for Veterans Affairs because he didn't spend any time in uniform. Martha Fudge said that she didn't want a stereotypical African-American cabinet job like HUD, and she really wanted agriculture. But she got HUD, and Tom Vilsack comes back would come back as Agriculture Secretary, and then Susan Rice, one of the nation's leading minds on foreign policy and national security, it becomes a policy advisor. Let's focus on Austin for the time being. 81 million people voted for Joe Biden. He wanted an African-American in the job, not Jay Johnson, who was deemed to have potentially some confirmation challenges. So Biden picked Austin, somebody with whom he's comfortable and he trusts, which are his key metrics. Gordon, start us off why you think that this is the wrong pick.
Let me make a couple of points on this, a little bit about this civil military question, a little bit about the business angle. I think they're two separate issues. We have here, oddly enough, is what I guess it was Winston Churchill described it as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. It's not really quite clear why he did not proceed to choose one of the two highly qualified civilian people that he had in front of him, Michel Flournoy or Jay Johnson, and went to the general, except perhaps for personal reasons. There are two big issues here. The big issue number one is this, is for me at least, is the civil military relations piece. I know Arnold and Michael talked about this a bit, but it's worth saying there's a reason why the president is named as the commander in chief in the Constitution. There's a reason why the Department of Defense was set up, 1947 National Security Act, the way it was set up with civilian leadership. There's a reason why this prohibition of 7-year distance was put in there and the exception made for a truly extraordinary human being, General George Marshall. There's a reason why in the Goldwater-Nichols Act in 1986, the chairman was made the principal military advisor to the president, but is not in the chain of command. The chain of command goes from the president to the SECDEF to the regional combatant commanders, not through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And it all has to do with civil-military relations and the tradition of civil-military relations in the United States. Sam Huntington said it best in The Soldier and the State, the point for the military is to be apolitical, and the point for the civilians is to be in control. Huntington, who's one of the great classic scholars in civil-military relations, is truly my Bible in this kind of situation. In 2016, I wrote a piece in the New York Times with two retired Army colonels, all three of us basically saying Mattis was not a good appointment, not because Mattis wasn't a good man, not because he wasn't a smart man, not because he didn't know defense, but because he was a recently retired military officer. There's a reason to have a civilian at the top of the Department of Defense. And what we're seeing here, I think, is an erosion of that. And it is embedded in a larger civil military issue that I think the nation faces, which was summarized in a book I co-edited called Mission Creep, which is about what Bob Gates calls the militarization of American foreign policy. It is putting uniforms increasingly in positions where they are doing and saying things that don't have to do with military operations, strategic judgment, military command. They have to do with broader issues of national policy, global engagement, things of that kind that are non-military issues, even though they have routine vehicles for expressing those views, which they do. The chairman, as the military advisor to the president, has the opportunity to express those views. So this raises a very, very serious question for me about civil-military relations, and it's that reason and that reason alone that I have serious doubts that it was wise to appoint General Austin, regardless of what other credentials he may carry. A 44-year service in the United States military makes him a military officer, a good one. That's fine. No problem with that. But it violates a very important constitutionally rooted tradition in American civil relations that has an important foundation. So there's serious questions that need to be raised about it. The other issue is his connections to the business world. You know, way back 30 years ago, I wrote a book called The Iron Triangle, and I have whole chapters on this issue of the service of military people in the corporate world in the defense industry, the arrival in the Defense Department of people who come from the defense industry. And basically my conclusion in that book 30 years ago, and it continues to be so today, is we're not going to be able to appoint somebody to these senior positions in the Department of Defense who are utterly devoid of knowledge of the defense industry and the defense production world. It's just not feasible and not sensible. But what is important is two things. One is the transparency of those connections. Right. So it's very important that the business connections of anybody who's appointed to these positions be public knowledge, the divestment of those interests to eliminate conflicts of interest, the recusal with respect to companies that they have been doing business with. All of those are very important points. And the other, of course, which is a separate issue from Austin, is the delay in the return to industry of anybody who's served in the Department of Defense. And there's a very good reason for this. A long legislative history. lots of investigations. And the good reason for it is when you're going back out, establishing distance between you and the people you dealt with allows the people you dealt with to disappear, which obviates the insider kind of connection you might have with them and focuses on your knowledge. So that's a whole nother area of questions that I think Austin is going to have to clarify in his hearings, in addition to what he thinks about policy and questions that people want to raise about military operations. But that's why I think this is a more important principle than has been sometimes discussed.
I appreciate all of those points. And Gordon, we're going to come back to them in a minute, because I think you're exactly right. I think that people are sort of stunned that some of the leading lights, the leading security minds, right? I mean, there are 330 million Americans, but there are a handful of people who at any given time are qualified, whether politically or in terms of capability. And of course, the Defense Department is one of those few places where capability sort of matters before you take a job, and that there are standards, and certainly particularly so in the acquisition side of things. And so there's this sense that, you know, what you're entering a very interesting world indeed, where Michelle Flournoy or a Jay Johnson are somehow deemed to be unconfirmable. Puts us in sort of a little bit of terra incognita. Dove, I want to bring you in on this, because you just wrote for a piece in The Hill. You're a commentator there. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, there are a lot of people who are hung on the fundamental question of, is Lloyd Austin any different at 10 years after uniform than he is 7 years after uniform, as he is 4 years after uniform? 81 million people voted for Joe Biden. This is the man that he's chosen to be his defense secretary. We can argue whether or not the logic itself that arrived at that conclusion may have been flawed. Why does it matter whether it's 4 years, 7 years, or 10 years, Dove?
First of all, it matters that there's a gap. That's not to say that you're not going to have exceptions. Jim Stavridis, brilliant admiral, within the year of his retirement is running the Fletcher School, which is clearly a civilian operation, and he didn't run it like an admiral. But on the other hand, you get a lot of people who take time getting out of the military mindset. If you've been serving in the military for decades, you may not ever come to terms with the fact that you're now a civilian. I think that's what motivated the 1947 Act to begin with. I just think that 7 years is far too long. And if you reduce it, I suggest that 4 years, you can make it three, you can make it five. But if you make it a shorter period, you're essentially opening up the pool of eligible candidates. And it seems to me that just because somebody's been a general, that doesn't necessarily eliminate him or her from being an excellent Secretary of Defense. And we've had an awful lot of terrible ones who were civilians all their lives. So to me, I don't think the issue is one of 7 years. There has to be, though, some kind of gap. In the case of Austin, the president could. I don't think that Johnson would have had anything like the trouble the president-elect thought he would have, nor do I think Michelle would have had a problem at all. The president was comfortable with Austin. He chose Austin. I hope he didn't choose Austin simply because he was black, because that, frankly, is an insult to Austin's career. But in any event, he's going to have a hard time, as I think Michael and Arnold said earlier in this program. He's going to have a hard time getting through, first of all, because he needs a House vote as well as a Senate vote. And there are going to be some awfully loud noises on the left side of the Democratic Party who might join up with Republicans who just want to make trouble to make it a very, very close vote indeed.
Michael, give us your sense. You've been talking to members all week. I know that there's been a lot of other issues that you've been focused on and that they've been focused on, but we have been hearing from members, right? We heard from Jim Inhofe and Jack Reed, the chairman and the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. We heard from Adam Smith, highly respected chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, and other members, Mike Gallagher, Alyssa Lopkin, and others who've said, look, this is just not the right pick at the end of the day. What are you picking up in terms of how this is going to be playing out? Because it would be awful for the president-elect to get a brushback on one of his most important nominees at the very beginning. And then there are people who are saying, look, there'll be political backlashes in Georgia and elsewhere if the first African-American who's nominated for this position somehow doesn't make it, because then people will think that there's a racial component to this, which the timing of which would be bad as well. How do you sense this all playing out? And then, Mackenzie, you want to get your take, because I know you've got to go in a couple of minutes. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, look, I agree with you. And I think there's lots of moving parts here. And I think part of the sense from, you know, Biden during his whole campaign did not have really good outreach to Capitol Hill. He was not asking for endorsements. He was not cultivating new relationships. And I think that's going to hurt him as he proceeds with this nomination fight and getting this waiver. But that being said, I still think that a lot of this is posturing. I think that I'm talking to Republicans and Democrats. I had a conversation with a Republican member yesterday on armed services who is opposed to the waiver, but he also thinks that the election was illegitimate as well, which is a whole nother story. So I think, you know, right now we see a lot of stories about the Democrats needing the Republicans to bail them out. I think the Smith and the Congressional Black Caucus in the House and Pelosi and the leadership will be able to get Biden what he needs in the House. And I think, you know, I understand the reasons behind, you know, needing this waiver and the statute, but when Mattis just got the waiver before, I think it really stings of a lot of hypocrisy not to do it again, especially for an African-American Secretary of Defense who would be going down in history as the first African-American Secretary of Defense. So I think we got a long way to go. I think the administration has its work cut out for them, but I might be naive, but I do believe that they're going to get this in the end.
Mackenzie, do you think that it ends up going through?
Prediction, 100% he's going through. He will be Secretary of Defense. I have no doubt about it. Michael is not being naive. A lot of this is posturing. You know, when Jack Reed, who took a very clear position after Mattis saying, I'll never do this again, when he came around saying, okay, I'm open to considering it for Lloyd Austin. I mean, this is going to happen. You know, the Democrats are going to want to give President Biden, when he becomes president, when he's sworn in, that honeymoon period that is traditional for every president, well, I guess, except Trump. And, you know, and try and move through, particularly jobs of such importance to national security. You know, we know from the 9/11 commission that, you know, that these are not ones you delay. You move them through quickly for a reason in case there is a big crisis early on. And they will. He's not going to sail through. But if you look at the evidence, Congress hasn't cared about civil military relations. They keep handing over, you know, gobs of power to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs every year, at least through 2018 in the authorization bills. This is not a real issue. I mean, it's an issue now all of a sudden, which I find really fascinating because Gordon and Dove did a great job talking about, you know, why they should care. But there's no evidence that Congress actually cares about civil military relations and that they're going to do anything meaningful about it, sort of independent of this issue of his confirmation. So yeah, he's going to, I hope we can revisit this on the day of the, I'll be on your pod that day, Vago, when we can talk about it again.
I intensely believe that civil military relations are a key point, and Gordon is absolutely right. I just think that the issue is far, far, far deeper than whether or not Lloyd Austin is in or not. There are much broader issues that we need to be discussing about service, the compensation for military service, the importance of national service, and the fundamental reality that you have less, you know, it's an increasingly shrinking percentage of the population that is going into the military. And of the people who are going into the military, it is becoming kind of a class of families, fourth, fifth, sixth, eighth generation, we serve in the military, that then is potentially very destabilizing. And something that Mike Mullen would talk about civil military relations, folks talked about the standpoint of society moving away from the military. But what people don't understand is that Mullen was equally concerned about military people seeing themselves as superior to society and thinking that they are at a different status and level, and that the kind of compensations that go with that, the tax breaks and other things, will also be divisive at a time when that delta becomes very, very big. So I think it's a much, much broader and bigger issue. Let me ask you one question, because I know you've got to go in a minute. You could argue that it's up to the president at the end of the day, and there was a whole bunch of reasons why he was more comfortable with Lloyd Austin. There are those who say, for example, the degree of pushback or support or the campaign to have Michelle nominated actually may have alienated Biden at the end of the day. So it's very, very hard to say that it was the industry links. There were some on the liberal wing of the Democratic Party who are concerned about Jay Johnson's policy stances when he was Homeland Security on immigration, when he was general counsel at DOD on drone strikes. What message does it send everybody? And Gordon, want to get your sense on this too. And Dove, what does that potentially say when the leading lights of your party, people who did yeoman work during the election, Jay Johnson deserves a lot of credit. I mean, he was on Fox and a lot of other venues, raised a lot of money. What signal does that send when they seem to be disqualified by their own party.
It's a terrible signal. There's like no sugarcoating it. It's just lipstick on a pig. If I tried, so I won't do it. It's really bad. And, you know, and it took a lot of wind out of the sails of people who were going to be inspired to work for Michelle. They're looking for jobs at State Department now and NSC and other places. And that's also discouraging. But really the worst part about this is the process. Lloyd Austin is taking so many arrows and Michelle took so many arrows that even if Austin's nomination for some reason were derailed, whoever comes behind him, let's say it was Michelle, she would, it's doing damage to both of them, which is really frustrating, I think, to their reputations, to just, there's too many different, as you said, there's so many different angles to this. But, you know, I'm confident that Michelle personally knows that, you know, one day she'll get the offer and she'll hope for that day and pick herself back up and march forward in the meantime.
And before you go, Mackenzie, I forgot to mention, you know, that we were talking about role of women in the military and concerns and the study after the Guillen incident and the importance of preventing sexual assault to show sort of progress in uniform. The first female commanding officer of an aircraft carrier will be Captain Amy Bauernschmidt aboard USS Abraham Lincoln, and will be the first woman to command one of the nation's most important military assets. So we wish her fair winds following seas. Bravo Zulu on that, and certainly hope that it's you know, it gets to the point where it's something that's so natural and normal that it doesn't require a special shout out. Having been aboard Abraham Lincoln and met her when she was executive officer, we wish her all the best. Mackenzie, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Gordon, I know you're champing at the bit, and I want to give you an opportunity to take a bite at this apple. Go ahead, you know, give us your sense. And what are the implications of this, right? I mean, here were two highly qualified candidates. It certainly falls to the president to make the choice. But at the end of the day, I mean, is there a negative implication, a negative impact? I mean, is this something that turns some people off who look at this and go, wow, I mean, if these two don't make the grade, I don't understand how I might.
As I say, it's a sort of mysterious riddle and enigma here that seems to be driven more by the relationship with the president-elect than anything else. I kind of hate to see it happening, I have to say. To some degree, I agree with Mackenzie on this. It's just a bit tawdry and a bit unpleasant to watch, and in some sense, a bit surprising, because up until these most recent spate of appointments, what the president-elect has done is pretty steadily, directively go right down the path of finding competent people and putting them in the right places. Now it feels to me like it's begun to sort of skitter off the personal rails. The fractures that are exposed in the Democratic Party on these things are fractures that have always been there in the Democratic Party and are going to be there in the future in the Democratic Party. You know, as Will Rogers said, he doesn't belong to an organized political party. He's a Democrat. So to some extent, personally, I'm not terribly surprised by this, but I do think it is unfortunate. And I've already raised the question of the civil military precedent, which I think is too bad and unfortunate, that two very competent people were not there. And yes, in their hearings, Jay Johnson would get questions about drone operations and some of his business contacts, and Michelle Flournoy would get a whole bunch of questions about what's exactly and all that. And that's fair game in any confirmation process. And it certainly would be fair game in the Congress as divided as this one, with the confirmation process conceivably being in Republican hands, because the Republicans win one or two of the Georgia seats that are up on January 5th. So I'm not too surprised, but it's also unfortunate. It feels to me a little bit right now like some unforced errors are being made that didn't have to be made.
I think people will agree with you on that, because if you didn't want Michelle and you didn't want Jay, then you should have just told them from the very beginning, it ain't going to be one of you two. It would have saved a lot of effort. They would have backed themselves out of it, and their allies would have then backed off as well. And it would have been, I think, a different dynamic than the one we had, right? I mean, if President-elect was uncomfortable with some of these choices, I think it would have been easier had it happened sooner. Because again, you don't want to damage your A-team folks who could populate key jobs in the future, and then the stress and tension and bad feelings that go with it. Again, as I said, all these people worked enormously hard they raised an enormous amount of money, and now they're feeling like they're a little bit on the outs when somebody takes over. But that said, right, we are surprised often by defense secretary picks in the first part of an administration. Dov, I know you've got quite a lot to say about this, so why don't we get your sense, because there were a couple of other key issues we've got to hit before we part for the week. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think this was a pick that hurts everybody. That's what we've heard already from Gordon and McKenzie. Look, Michelle would have cleared. So would Jay. The problem, first of all, and this compounds something I wrote about last week. Last week, I wrote that by not picking someone, Biden was going to worry allies that maybe a defense secretary wouldn't be as important. Now he picks somebody who is going to be controversial, who's going to get through, but get through with a tough vote in both houses, who's a Middle East expert when the priority is supposed to be China and Russia. And so people are going to be scratching their heads. And it's not fair to Austin, because he is a very capable man. It's not fair to Michelle and Jay. And frankly, it's Biden hurt himself doing this. Because it simply is a choice that is doesn't make sense to a lot of people, as you just heard. I think there will be a female deputy secretary. I think it's going to be Kath Hicks. She's led the transition team. She's very capable. She also happens to be close to Michelle and probably wouldn't get the job if Michelle had been secretary, because I don't think there would have been two women at the top. Now I think she's clearly the leader in that regard.
You don't think it could be Liz Sherwood Randall, who is a former deputy secretary of Homeland of Energy and close to Biden?
She's close to Biden. And that'll be interesting if, again, somebody who's as talented and as knowledgeable as Kath Hicks, who served on the National Strategy Commission, who's been his top DOD transition person, is passed over for somebody who, admittedly, Liz is an energy expert, but nobody's ever seen her as a defense expert. So he could do it, and he'll be doing it because he's comfortable, and that'll raise questions about, are you going for the best person, or are you going for the person that you'd like to share a cup of a beer with? He's not helping himself in that regard. And as I say, it's not been fair to anybody in this process, not to Michelle, not to Jay, certainly not to Austin. He doesn't deserve a close vote. He should do a lot better than that, and not to the president himself, president-elect.
Michael, we've got a couple of minutes left, but I want to get your sense on this. We've got just a couple of minutes left, and we're going to go into a little bit of a lightning round, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this question, Michael. Joe Biden is seen as a creature of the Senate, understands the Senate, you respect the Senate, and generally when committee chairmen tell you something, you listen to them. And in this case, the committee chairman said stuff, and they felt like they were ignored, nor were they brought into this decision, because some of them were making statements. Adam Smith, for example, ended up endorsing Michelle Flournoy, even though the decision had been made days before that Biden was going to go for Austin. And these senior leaders don't like to be, you know, made out to be both either uninformed or on the wrong side of a decision. Is this something that could have lasting implications for how the Biden team is going to get its agenda through, right? I mean, if Joe Biden wants to transform the nation and the military the way we think or suspect that he does, one of the reasons why he wants a Lloyd Austin there is to execute his vision, not Michelle executing her vision or Jay executing their, you know, his vision, but Austin executing Biden's vision. Does this complicate things? Is there going to be some bad blood here that might end up complicating things going downstream?
Personally, I don't think so. I also think when it comes to the Biden agenda, I think it's going to be very hard for him to get much of an agenda through Congress anyway, because the House majority for the Democrats will be somewhere around 5 seats, and the Senate could be 52-48 or 50-50. So I think that we're just going to we'll be lucky just to get the basic workings of government done over the next 2 years. And I think there's much bigger fights on the horizon, both internally for the Democrats and internally for the Republicans as well. And this will be in the rearview mirror after the confirmation is done.
Gordon, I'm going to give you a word, and then Dov gets lightning round on two quick questions. Go ahead, because I know you've got something that you want to add.
Yeah, just one thought on this deputy secretary question. One of the most important things that the department needs in a deputy secretary is understands the inside of the building, understands management, understands process, understands budgets, because they run the budget process at the top in the Department of Defense. I think Kathy Hicks is qualified for almost any job she'd have at the Defense Department. I'd particularly love to see her as Undersecretary of Policy, because she's done so much work on policy, touched all the bases, she consults with everybody outside the government from A to Z, really knows what she's talking about, knows what the chiefs think. She'd be a really great Undersecretary of Policy.
And she has thought deep and hard about both the strategic challenges the department faces. She's also looked at the budgetary impacts, and she did a study, if I recall, time blurs, but over the course of I can't remember if it was last year, but an assessment of how the department could maybe do with smaller budget. That's also an important thing to have thought through when you come into government. Our time is running short, Dove, but I want to give you a bite at two apples. The rejection of the UAE joint resolution of disapproval for F-35s going to the United Arab Emirates. But first, I want to ask you about the Defense Business Board. We've been talking about management. Michael Baer was chairman of the Defense Business Board. Arnold Panaro was a member of that. Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller dissolved the board and fired nine of its members and replaced them with close allies of President Trump. This is happening across these kind of advisory boards across the piece. You were actually in the Bush administration where you created the Defense Business Board. Tell us why boards like this are so important and why the original guiding philosophy of not bipartisanship, but nonpartisanship was such an essential piece of this.
Well, the Defense Business Board, I created it because we needed to improve the way the Defense Department does its business, as simple as that. People like Arnold, people like Michael knew the department inside out. They had great ideas about how we should make it more efficient. All one has to do is look at the board's website to see the kinds of issues that have been addressed over the years, personnel issues, management issues, financial issues. This is not partisan in the least. And for the acting secretary to fire these kinds of talented people, and not just the two of them, all nine of them are very talented. The vice chairman, Atul Vashtista, is an Indian American who's a brilliant businessman, and replace them with the likes of Corey Lewandowski. It shows you that there was no understanding at all of what this board should do and the advisory nature of boards generally. Frankly, it was an outrage.
And I should also point out that it was a conversation that you and Arnold Panaro had, where Arnold recommended, hey, this would be kind of a great thing to do. And I should also point out that you too have served on the Defense Business Board with some distinction over the years.
Yes, it was Arnold's idea. We served together on Bill Cohen's Defense Reform Task Force. And so when I took over as comptroller, I took his idea and ran with it, and I give him credit for the idea. But that's Arnold, and that's why guys like that should not have been thrown off the board.
Let me ask you very briefly about the resolution on the UAE. Michael, you're recused because I think you successfully lobbied on behalf of the UAE to get to this end. But putting everything else aside, why was it important from your standpoint? I know that you have an excellent relationship with folks across the region, including the senior UAE leadership. What was the signal that would have been sent, and why is this a positive outcome from your standpoint?
It would have been a disaster for a number of reasons. First, it would have been yet another case of America giving its word and breaking it. And in a time when we have the Chinese blandishing anybody they can blandish and then blackmailing them, and the Russians not bothering to blandish but simply to invade, for the United States not to keep its word would really be bad news over the next decade. That's number one. Number two, the Israelis didn't object to this. And, there seems to have been a tacit agreement that the recognition, which has gone well beyond recognition, I mean, businessmen in the Emirates are learning Hebrew, for God's sake. But that the recognition was in some way connected to the F-35s. And so who knows how this would have damaged what looks like a very successful Abraham Accords that's now extended not just to Port Sudan, but to Morocco, which is a very, very important state because the king, His Majesty, is the chairman of the Jerusalem Committee in the Islamic Conference. So this is a big deal. Going back on the UAE deal could have undermined all of that. And so all I can say is, thank God, alhamdulillah, as you might say in the region, that this thing passed.
I will point out, though, that the United States has made some rather extraordinary concessions, including in the case of Morocco and disputed international territory, in order to be able to get this, right? I mean, so this has been, everybody has managed to get what they want in order for us to be able to say we got the deal.
Right. Yeah, but there's no question about that, Vago. But the fact of the matter is, if you gave your word. If maybe we shouldn't have given our word in all of these cases. That's a whole different debate. All I'm saying is, right, once the United States gives its word should be bond. And the problem we have, and I heard this from a former Pakistani prime minister not long ago, when I asked him, why does China get your attention and not America? He said, very simple. China is an all-weather friend. You guys are a fair-weather friend, and we don't trust you.
Which is very regrettable. Gordon, you get the last word because you have a Defense Policy Board observation you want to make. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a sense that this is a little bit of a tempest in a teapot, in part because in both of these boards' cases, they serve at the pleasure of the Secretary of Defense. I'm somewhat more perturbed by the Defense Business Board one because it really has operated in a nonpartisan way. And Mike Bayer was an absolutely fantastic chairman of it. Twice they did some remarkable work on things like military retirement and on overhead size and costs in the Department of Defense. Really seminal work that has not a touch of partisanship in it. And they've done some serious studies. A policy board is somewhat different. It is too a federal advisory board, but it is more, if you will, it's part of the administration's club. I served on it from 1997 to 2000. It was a wonderful series of meetings. We didn't fund studies. We didn't do a lot of strategic work. We listened to Secretary Cohen. We opined in the meetings and we moved on. And the membership of the policy board rotates virtually all the time with the new administration. So in 2021, I got a very terse note, Dove may have even signed off on it, from Donald Rumsfeld saying, thank you for your service, goodbye. I was neither surprised nor hurt that happened. And they proceeded to appoint people that were more congenial to that incoming secretary. And in a way, it's just sort of business as usual. Business Board was doing some really serious, excellent nonpartisan work.
Guys, thanks very, very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Happy Hanukkah to everybody. Certainly look forward to having you guys back on again next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vago.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.